Front Pages. For the next hour, Chris will bring you the front page news from the morning newspapers, the latest headlines from around the state and around the rest of the world.
Hello, it's Sunday, April 21st. I'm Lisa Bowman, and reading the front pages of the Hartford Courant, the New York Times, and the Manchester Journal-Enquirer with me is Scott Becker. Now let's take a look at the photos on the front pages of today's papers. We'll begin with the New York Times. At the very top of the paper, in the upper left-hand corner, above the fold, taking up much of that area, we see a picture of some young people in military garb. In the left part of the picture, we see only a partial face. The person is standing, taking up most of the left-hand side of the picture. And as I said, we see only half of their face. They have on a checkered scarf. A camo brown bag is slung over their shoulder, and they have gray and white camo on. Next to that person kneeling, and in the center of the picture, is a young man with no helmet, a dark black shirt, green camo gear over him. He is sitting down, and he is holding a rifle in his left hand, on an angle, the butt rested on his leg and the muzzle pointing in the air. And to the right is one more person. Again, they're wearing a black face mask. They have on a black cap, camo gear, and again, holding some sort of military equipment. And this has to do with an ongoing war that is happening in Myanmar, which we will be bringing you a story on in just a few minutes. Below that picture and below the fold, we see an empty hockey rink, all except for some players there on the ice. So the picture, basically we have seats in the hockey rink to the left that are empty. And they're taking that side of the picture is taking up about a third of the picture. And we are looking straight down the divider glass between the seats and the rink itself. And then on the right side of the divider glass, we see some players, some hockey players. Some are in blue jerseys and blue pants, and others are in brown jerseys and brown pants. And there's about five or six of them sort of struggling for the puck in the forefront of the picture. And this has to do with a new pro hockey team that is located in New York, but does not have home ice or a name yet. The last picture that is appearing in the New York Times is over to the right, just above the fold, and is about in the middle of the paper, and we see a Chinese athlete waving. We're seeing this person from the waist up. The background of the picture is that we see some stadium lights behind them, two rows of stadium lights. And then in the foreground, this athlete is waving. They have on a white warm-up jacket with red piping, and they are carrying a bouquet of flowers in their left hand. And this athlete is named Wang Shun, and they are the 2022 Asian Games winner in Tokyo. But there is some question about these athletes. They are swimmers, and they all tested positive for a disallowed substance. Moving on to pictures from the Hartford Courant, there are only two pictures on the Hartford Courant, and they are both related to the same story. They are related to Bradley Airport and specifically deals on flying this summer. The top picture shows the tarmac in at Bradley Airport, just a portion of it. We're actually looking at gate number 9, and we see sitting on that tarmac is a JetBlue plane. The tail of the plane has blue and green rectangles on the tail. interspersed on a dark blue background. And then in the lower third of that tail section, you see jet blue painted on the tail. The airplane itself is white. The engines are painted blue. And up towards the door where the cockpit is, you see jet blue in blue letters. As we keep moving forward in the picture towards us, we see the people carrier. It says 9 on it, and it's over to the left, with the stairs extended to the bottom of the tarmac. And then in front of that, we see a baggage carrier, a truck with a yellow bumper on it with some cones in the back. And then next to the plane itself, another white truck. And then scattered on the tarmac are some cones in various places. And we see a worker walking near one of those sets of cones. The picture down below shows the tracker of flights at Bradley Airport, but on an angle. So we're looking at it. The tracker is on our right-hand side, and we're seeing basically different flight numbers and whether they are on time or not. And then if the picture is on an angle, so if we keep looking to the left of the flight tracker, we see some people lining up at airline counters with luggage, getting ready to depart. And this all has to do, as I said, with a story about travel deals this summer at our airports. So with that, we are going to move on to our first stories of the day. And our first stories of the day have to deal with international news. And our first story is entitled "Sudan's Horrific War is Being Fueled by Weapons from Foreign Supporters of Rival Generals," UN says. Dateline United Nations. The year-old war in Sudan between rival generals vying for power has sparked a crisis of epic proportions, fueled by weapons from foreign supporters who continue to flout UN sanctions aimed at helping end the conflict, the UN political chief said Friday. "This is illegal, it is immoral, and it must stop," Undersecretary General Rosemary DiCarlo told the UN Security Council. Sudan plunged into chaos in mid-April 2023 when long simmering tensions between its military, led by General Abdel Fattah Burhan, and the Rapid Support Forces paramilitary commanded by Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo broke out into street battles in the capital, Khartoum. Fighting has spread to other parts of the country, especially urban areas and the Western Darfur region. DiCarlo painted a dire picture of the war's impact: over 14,000 dead, tens of thousands wounded, looming famine with 25 million people in need of life-saving assistance, and over 8.6 million forced to flee their homes. Mohamed Imban Shabas, chair of the African Union panel on Sudan and high representative for its Silence the Guns in Africa initiative, called external interference a major factor compounding both the efforts to negotiate a ceasefire and to stop the war. As a matter of fact, external support in terms of supply of war material and other needs has been the main reason why this war has lasted so long, Chambas said. It is the elephant in the room. Neither DiCarlo nor Chambas named any of the foreign supporters. But Burhan, who led a military takeover of Sudan in 2021, is a close ally of neighboring Egypt and its president, former army chief Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. In February, Sudan's foreign minister held talks in Tehran with his Iranian counterpart amid unconfirmed reports of drone purchases for government forces. The Rapid Support Forces leader, Dagalo, has reportedly received support from Russia's Wager Mercenary Group. UN experts said in a recent report that the RSF has also received support from Arab allied communities and new military supply lines running through Chad, Libya, and South Sudan. The Arab-dominated RSF has carried out brutal attacks in Darfur on ethnic African civilians, especially the ethnic Masalit, and has taken control of most of the vast region. Its newest target appears to be El Fasher, the capital of North Darfur. Adem Wassonou, the UN Humanitarian Office's Director of Operations, said RSF-affiliated militias attacked and burned villages west of El Fasher on April 13th. Our next story is entitled, A Ragtag Resistance Sees the Tide Turning in a Forgotten War. Rebel fighters have handed Myanmar's army defeat after defeat, for the first time raising the possibility that the military junta could be at risk of collapse. The night Ma Suu Kyi thought she would die of her wounds on the front lines of a forgotten war, a crescent moon hung overhead. A pendant of the Virgin Mary dangled around her neck. Maybe those augurs saved her, or maybe, she said, it was not yet time for her to die. When I joined the revolution, I knew my chances of surviving were 50-50, Ms. Suu Kyi, 21, said of her decision to enlist as a rebel soldier, fighting to overthrow the junta that returned Myanmar to military dictatorship 3 years ago. I'm an ordinary girl, an ordinary young person. I believe in federal democracy and human rights. Ms. Suu Kyi said the words federal democracy in English. There are no easy words for the concept in Burmese. Since the junta in Myanmar staged its coup in February 2021, ending a brief period of democratic reform and training its guns once again on peaceful protesters, much of the country has turned against the military, a new generation which came of age during the civilian administration of the Nobel laureate Daw Aung San Suu Kyi, has taken to arms, joining rebels who have opposed military dictatorship for decades. The world's gaze has remained focused on other conflicts on other continents, to the consternation of many in Myanmar, who wonder why the chaos and death here brings little global outcry. Now, after 3 years of desperate resistance, the battle lines are changing fast. The rebels have overrun scores of military bases and taken over dozens of towns. The tempo of victory has quickened in recent days, and anti-junta forces now claim to control more than half of Myanmar's territory, from lowland jungles to the foothills of the Himalayas. Much of the fighting rhythm seems syncopated to that of another century. Trenches dug into unrelenting mud, the slide of flip-flops down monsoon-soaked hills, the clatter of homemade AK-style assault rifles in dusty towns. The junta's multiple rocket launchers and fighter jets may bring a modern touch to the killing, as does the hovering of the resistance's battle drones. But this conflict, with its hand-to-hand combat and profusion of landmines, feels like a throwback to the kind of civil war that was documented in black and white. If they manage to push into the nation's heartland, no sure thing, the insurgents could unseat a military that has, in one form or another, kept Myanmar in its grip for more than half a century. The result may not be so much a shifting of power as a shattering of a nation, its vast periphery breaking permanently away from central control. Our next story is entitled, Haitians Scramble to Survive, Seeking Food, Water, and Safety as Gang Violence Chokes the Capital. Dateline, Port-au-Prince, Haiti. As the sun sets, a burly man bellows into a megaphone while a curious crowd gathers around him. Next to him is a small cardboard box with several banknotes worth 10 Haitian gourds, about 7 U.S. cents. Everyone give whatever they have, the man shouts as he grabs the arms and hands of people entering a neighborhood in the capital, Port-au-Prince, that has been targeted by violent gangs. The community recently voted to buy a metal barricade and install it themselves to try to protect residents from the unrelenting violence that killed or injured more than 2,500 people in Haiti from January to March. Every day I wake up and find a dead body, said Noon Carme Manoon, an immigration officer. Life in Port-au-Prince has become a game of survival, pushing Haitians to new limits as they scramble to stay safe and alive while gangs overwhelm the police and the government remains largely absent. Some are installing metal barricades. Others press hard on the gas while driving near gang-controlled areas. The few who can afford it stockpile water, food, money, and medication, supplies of which have dwindled since the main international airport closed in early March. The country's biggest seaport is largely paralyzed by marauding gangs. People living in the capital are locked in. They have nowhere to go, Philippe Branchat, International Organization for Migration chief in Haiti, said in a recent statement. The capital is surrounded by armed groups and danger. It is a city under siege. Phones ping often with alerts reporting gunfire, kidnappings, and fatal shootings. And some supermarkets have so many armed guards that they resemble small police stations. Gang attacks used to occur only in certain areas, but now they can happen anywhere, anytime. Staying home does not guarantee safety. One man playing with his daughter at home was shot in the back by a stray bullet. Others have been killed. Schools and gas stations are shuttered with fuel on the black market selling for $9 a gallon, roughly three times the official price. Banks have prohibited customers from withdrawing more than $100 a day, and checks that used to take 3 days to clear now take a month or more. Police officers have to wait weeks to be paid. Everyone is under stress, said Isidore Gédéon, a 38-year-old musician. After the prison break, people don't trust anyone. The state doesn't have control. Gangs that control an estimated 80% of Port-au-Prince launched coordinated attacks on February 29th, targeting critical state infrastructure. They set fire to police stations, shot up the airport, and stormed into Haiti's two biggest prisons, releasing more than 4,000 inmates. At the time, Prime Minister Ariel Henry was visiting Kenya to push for the UN-backed deployment of a police force. Henry remains locked out of Haiti, and a transitional presidential council tasked with selecting the country's next prime minister and cabinet could be sworn in as early as this week. Henri has pledged to resign once a new leader is installed. Our next story is entitled Indians Vote in the First Phase of the World's Largest Election as Modi Seeks a Third Term. Dateline New Delhi. Millions of Indians began voting Friday in a 6-week election that's a referendum on Narendra Modi, the populist prime minister. Who has championed an assertive brand of Hindu nationalist politics and is seeking a rare third term as the country's leader? People began queuing up at polling stations hours before they were allowed in at 7 a.m. in the first 21 states to hold votes. From the Himalayan mountains to the tropical Andaman Islands, nearly 970 million voters, more than 10% of the world's population, will elect 543 members to the lower house of parliament for 5 years during the staggered elections that run until June 1st. The votes will be counted on June 4th. This election is seen as one of the most consequential in India's history and will test the limits of Modi's political dominance. If Modi wins, he'll be only the second Indian leader to retain power for a third term, after Jawaharlal Nehru, the country's first prime minister. Most polls predict a win for Modi and his Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party, who are up against a broad opposition alliance led by Indian National Congress and powerful regional parties. It's not clear who will lead India if the opposition alliance called INDIA, INDIA, wins the election. It's more than 20 parties have not put forward a candidate yet. The BJP controls much of India's Hindi-speaking northern and central parts, but is now trying to gain a foothold in the east and south. Their toughest challenge is in the southern Tamil Nadu state, with 39 seats, where voting is being held Friday. Voters in hot and humid Chennai, the state's capital, began briskly filling the city's nearly 4,000 polling booths. A number of them said they were voting for a change in federal government, given rising prices, unemployment, and religious polarization stoked by the BJP. First thing I came to vote is to have a country without any religious disharmony. In Tamil Nadu, Hindus, Muslims, Christians were all together, and this unity should grow, said 65-year-old Mary Das, who was waiting to vote. P. Chidambaram, an opposition Congress party leader and the country's former finance minister, said that people of Tamil Nadu would not vote for the BJP as it is imposing one language, one culture, one system, and one kind of food. The BJP has long struggled to capture votes in the state, where two powerful regional parties, the Dravida Munnetra Kazhagam and All India Anna Dravida Munnetra Kazhagam, dominate. The BJP drew a blank in 2019 and won one seat in 2014. In Rajasthan, people returning from polling stations covered their heads against dusty winds. If the new government is able to solve unemployment, then it will be good. People are migrating from this region to earn a living, said Antanir Singh, 26. Well, now's the time when we take a look at your weather. Today, Sunday, partial sunshine, high 57, low 39. Monday, mostly sunny, high 58, low 34. Tuesday, partly sunny, high 59, low 46. Wednesday, cloudy with a couple of showers, high 59, low 41. And Thursday, partly sunny, breezy in the afternoon, high 59, low 40. Now we'll turn our attention to stories of national interest. Our first story is entitled, Biden Avoids a Further Mideast Spiral as Israel and Iran Show Restraint, but for how long? Dateline Washington. President Joe Biden can breathe a bit easier, at least for the moment, now that Israel and Iran appear to have stepped back from the brink of tipping the Middle East into all-out war. Israel's retaliatory strikes on Iran and Syria caused limited damage. The restrained action came after Biden urged Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government to temper its response to Iran's unprecedented direct attack on Israel last week and avoid an escalation of violence in the region. Iran's barrage of drones and missiles inflicted little damage and followed a suspected Israeli attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus this month that killed two generals. Iran's public response to the Israeli strikes Friday also was muted, raising hopes that Israel-Iran tensions, long carried out in the shadows with cyber attacks, assassinations, and sabotage, will stay at a simmer. The situation remains a delicate one for Biden as he gears up his re-election effort. In the face of headwinds in the Mideast, Russia, and the Indo-Pacific, all are testing the proposition he made to voters during his 2020 campaign that a Biden White House would bring a measure of calm and renewed respect for the United States on the world stage. Foreign policy matters are not typically the top issue for American voters. This November is expected to be no different, with economy and border security carrying greater resonance. But public polling suggests that overseas concerns could have more relevance with voters than in any U.S. election since 2006, when voter dissatisfaction over the Iraq War was a major factor in the Republican Party losing 30 House and 6 Senate seats. We see this issue rising in saliency, and at the same time, we're seeing voter appeals of President Biden's handling. I'm sorry, we're at a time we're seeing voter appraisals of President Biden's handling of foreign affairs being quite negative, said Christopher Borick, director of the Muhlenberg College Institute of Public Opinion. That combination is not a great one for Biden. Biden has staked enormous political capital on his response to the Israel-Hamas war, as well as his administration's backing of Ukraine as it fends off a Russian invasion. The apparent de-escalation of tensions between Israel and Iran also comes as the House on Saturday approved $95 billion in wartime aid for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, a measure that Biden has pushed for as Ukrainian forces run desperately short on arms. House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican Louisiana, pushed the package forward after months of delay as he faced the threat of ouster by his party's right flank. The legislation now awaits a vote in the Senate. The new money would provide a surge of weaponry to the front lines, giving the White House renewed hope that Ukraine can right the ship after months of setbacks in the war. Biden also has made bolstering relations in the Indo-Pacific a central focus of his foreign policy agenda, looking to win allies and build ties as China becomes a more formidable economic and military competitor. But Republicans, including former President Donald Trump, have an argument to make that Biden's policies have contributed to the U.S. dealing with myriad global quandaries, said Richard Goldberg, a senior advisor at the Washington think tank Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Our next story is entitled Biden Signs Bill Extending a Key U.S. Surveillance Program After Divisions Nearly Forced It to Lapse. Dateline Washington. President Joe Biden on Saturday signed legislation reauthorizing a key U.S. surveillance law after divisions over whether the FBI should be restricted from using the program to search for Americans' data nearly forced the statute to lapse. Barely missing its midnight deadline, the Senate had approved the bill by a 60 to 34 vote hours earlier with bipartisan support, extending for 2 years the program known as Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Biden thanked congressional leaders for their work. In the nick of time, we are reauthorizing FISA right before it expires at midnight, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said when voting on final passage began 15 minutes before the deadline. All day long, we persisted in trying to reach a breakthrough, and in the end, we have succeeded. U.S. officials have said the surveillance tool, first authorized in 2008 and renewed several times since then, is crucial in disrupting terrorist attacks, cyber intrusions, and foreign espionage, and has also produced intelligence that the U.S. has relied on for specific operations, such as the 2022 killing of al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri. If you miss a key piece of intelligence, you may miss some event overseas or put troops in harm's way, Florida Senator Marco Rubio, the top Republican on the Senate Intelligence Committee, said. You may miss a plot to harm the country here, domestically, or somewhere else. So in this particular case, there's real-life implications. The proposal would renew the program, which permits the U.S. government to collect, without a warrant, the communications of non-Americans located outside the country to gather foreign intelligence. The reauthorization faced a long and bumpy road to final passage Friday after months of clashes between privacy advocates and national security hawks pushed consideration of the legislation to the brink of expiration. Our next story is entitled The Town at the Center of a Supreme Court Battle Over Homelessness. A lawsuit by a group of homeless residents of a small Oregon town could reshape the way cities across the country deal with homelessness. Inside a warming shelter, Laura Gutkowski detailed how her life had changed since she became homeless 2.5 years ago in Grants Pass, a former timber hub in the foothills of southern Oregon. Her husband's death left her without steady income. She lived in a sedan and then in a tent in sight of the elementary school where her son was once a student. She constantly scrambled to move her belongings to avoid racking up more fines from the police. "I never expected it to come to this," Ms. Gutkowski, 55, said. She is one of several hundred homeless people in the city of about 40,000 that is at the center of a major case before the Supreme Court on Monday with broad ramifications for the nationwide struggle with homelessness. After grants passed, stepped up enforcement of local ordinances that ban sleeping and camping in public spaces by ticketing, fining, and jailing the homeless, lower courts ruled that it amounted to cruel and unusual punishment by penalizing people who had nowhere else to go. Many states and cities that are increasingly overwhelmed by homelessness are hoping the Supreme Court overturns that decision or severely limits it. They argue that it has crippled their efforts to address sprawling encampments, rampant public drug use, and fearful constituents who say they cannot safely use public spaces. That prospect has alarmed homeless people and their advocates, who contend that a ruling against them would lead cities to fall back on jails instead of solutions like affordable housing and social services. The case highlights the forced divide. The case highlights the fierce divide over the thorny issue of how to regulate homelessness. Theanne Amvagelis, a lawyer representing Grants Pass, said the Supreme Court's decision would widely reverberate. If it does not overturn the lower court decision, she said, cities around the United States would find their hands tied just like Grants Pass, and the problem of growing encampments will spread throughout the country. Ed Johnson, a lawyer for the Oregon Law Center, a nonprofit legal aid group who represents the homeless residents, said a ruling against them would strip them of their few protections. Can a city make it illegal on every inch of city land, every minute of the day, for people to live outside when they have nowhere else to go? Homelessness across the country climbed to the highest total on record last year, increasing by 12% to more than 650,000 people, according to a count by the federal government. Questions around how far cities can go in policing homelessness have exploded, in part because of a crucial decision in 2018 by the appeals court and a case from Boise, Idaho. It ruled that penalizing someone for sleeping outdoors if no shelter beds were available was a violation of the Eighth Amendment's protection against cruel and unusual punishment. Shortly afterwards, a group of homeless people in Grants Pass challenged the city's ordinances. A federal judge temporarily sided with the plaintiffs, finding the city had no shelter that met the requirements from the 2018 decision. The divided three-judge panel of the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit agreed, and the city challenged the ruling, asking the Supreme Court to weigh in. We'll be back with more of the front pages after this message.
Located in beautiful Waterford, Connecticut, Oak Hills Camp Harkness is hiring for the summer. Our fully accessible camp is designed to meet the interests and needs of children and adults along the disability spectrum by providing activities that are creative, adventurous, and fun. We are looking for counselors, lifeguards, and team leaders, just to name a few. This opportunity is perfect for recent high school graduates or college students looking to make a difference this summer. Join Oak Hill for a summer you will always remember with individuals you will never forget. Oak Hill's Camp Harkness, empowering people with disabilities. To find out more, visit oakhillct.org.
Now we'll focus on stories that are more state interest. Our first story is entitled, "Lamont Won't Say If He'll Ease Debt Diet to Make Connecticut Budget Fix Work." Democrat legislators seek borrowing to avoid cuts in core programs. Since his first weeks on the job, Governor Ned Lamont has urged his fellow Democrats to embrace a debt diet and curb borrowing when possible. But the administration wouldn't say this week whether it would back legislative leaders' plans to borrow to effectively cover operating expenses in the next budget, creating a significant hole to be tackled 1 year from now. Governor Lamont is committed to an honestly balanced budget in fiscal year 25. Any adjustments that impact any level of funding must ensure the budget remains balanced, Chris Colaby, the governor's budget spokesman, told the Connecticut Mirror this week. At first glance, this answer appears to close off options for Democratic legislators who want to add $300 million to $400 million to a preliminary $26 billion budget for the next fiscal year that already exceeds the state's spending cap by $30 million. But borrowing happens outside of the budget. The same applies to spending federal pandemic relief grants. The majority Democrats' latest plan to bolster the next state budget beyond what the spending cap allows centers on those two areas. It goes like this. Step one, identify projects and programs currently paid for with the last vestiges of Connecticut's $2.8 billion American Rescue Plan Act allocation from Congress. Step two, replace those ARPA, that's A-R-P-A dollars, with borrowed funds. Step three, reassign ARPA dollars to higher education, social services, and other core programs. Emergency federal relief can be spent outside of the spending cap, which tries to keep most expenditure growth in line with changes in household income and inflation. This approach effectively would circumvent the spending cap and other fiscal principles that Lamont frequently espouses. But borrowing for ongoing expenses adds an interest cost normally reserved for capital projects. The administration repeatedly chastised public colleges and university systems this past winter for using ARPA dollars for operating costs rather than for one-time purposes, such as paying down debt. Yet this latest Democratic strategy would pump more temporary dollars into ongoing programs. Lamont recently upgraded his estimate of ARPA dollars available for use next fiscal year from $56 million to $200 million, much closer to the $300 million minimum sought by Democratic legislators. This week, House Speaker Matt Ritter told the Connecticut Mirror that legislators hope to replace $75 million in ARPA funds earmarked for municipal school HVAC, that's HVAC, system upgrades with $75 million in borrowing. Does Lamont's upgrade $200 million ARPA tally reflect this proposed supplanting of pandemic grants with borrowing? Could available ARPA be expanded to $300 million or more by identifying more ARPA-funded projects and instead paying for them by borrowing the money? The administration will not comment on what is or is not included in the ARPA tally until we've had further conversations with the General Assembly, Colaby said. Our next story is entitled Utility Rate Increase Approval by PURA, that's P-U-R-A, raises alarm in state legislature. The decision by the Public Utility Regulatory Authority to approve rate increases for Eversource and United Illuminating elicited a strong reaction from the state capitol Friday. Comments from one of the utility companies further enraged a Democratic senator. Senator Norm Needleman, a Democrat from Essex who chairs the Energy and Technology Committee, said in a statement Friday morning that the recent comments by utility providers in the state in the wake of PURA's decision to agree to rate increases for payers shows a lack of commitment to the future of energy in Connecticut. If Eversource does not want to make green energy investments in our grid, for which it receives full reimbursement and an additional profit on top of out-of-pocket costs, maybe we should consider a review for their franchise agreement, which allows them to operate as a monopoly with no competition. The PURA commissioners voted 2-1, with Chairman Marissa Gillette being the dissenting vote, to agree to proposed rate increases for the state's utility providers. Those increases will reportedly be an additional $30 on the bills of United Illuminating customers. Eversource has not indicated how much residential customer bills will increase. The rate increases will take effect on July 1st and will be in effect for 10 months. Gillette issued a written dissent after the decision, in which she said was disappointed. Unfortunately, though, today's decision by Pura is likely to place further financial strain on those that can least afford it, and it will also hit the pocketbooks of our business community in a particularly challenging way, her dissent read. Republican legislative leaders said in a statement Thursday that the decision by Pura and the requests by Eversource are a reflection of Democrat policies. They reiterated that the government should complete his appointments to the Pura board, and that those who join the board should be vetted by the legislature. It's past time for the Democrats and the governor to get serious about charting a sensible and sustainable path forward on energy issues, the statement read. Failure to act will only add to the uncertainty over the cost, scope, and timeline of much-needed improvements to our state's fragile grid, and ultimately cause more frustration among ratepayers who are fed up with escalating costs. Our next story is entitled, A Year After Launch, Husky for Immigrants Sees Strong Demand. Advocates want the state to expand coverage this session to residents 18 and under, regardless of immigration status, but budget constraints present a challenge. A Connecticut law expanding state-sponsored insurance coverage to certain children, regardless of immigration status, has seen explosive demand since it went into effect nearly 14 months ago. More than 11,000 children, 12 and under, who wouldn't otherwise qualify for Medicaid because of their immigration status, now receive state-sponsored Medicaid-like coverage. Before the measure went into effect in January 2023, the Department of Social Services, or DSS, estimated that roughly 4,250 kids would enroll. Sometimes there's trepidation on the part, especially of non-citizens, to participate in government programs, said Peter Hadler, the deputy commissioner at DSS. The good news is that that has not proven to be a barrier, and people are enrolling at strong rates, and they're seeking this out. Hadler credits the high enrollment in large part to the work that community partners have done to spread the word and make people feel comfortable enrolling. The coverage expansion has also gone beyond just children. In April 2022, pregnant people, regardless of immigration status, became eligible for prenatal coverage, and the following year, that was expanded to also include 12 months of postpartum coverage. As of January 2024, 1,900 residents who wouldn't otherwise qualify based on their immigration status were enrolled in prenatal coverage, and roughly 2,000 were enrolled in postpartum coverage. Since the expansion, Bianca Noronias, the director of the Maternal Health Center at the Hispanic Health Council, said she no longer sees patients skipping appointments for fear of the cost. We have seen the difference. Now the families don't have these economic concerns when they need to go to prenatal visits, she said. She's also seeing patients take advantage of the coverage during pregnancy and postpartum to address other health needs like dental work and mental health care. In general, advocates said they're pleased with the number of people enrolling in coverage and appreciate how collaborative DSS has been since the rollout. But they say they won't be satisfied until they achieve coverage for everyone, regardless of immigration status. Our next story is entitled, No Walk in the Park, Road Design a Threat to Walkers and Bikers. Leap Day was a bad day to be out for a walk. On the evening of February 29th, a pedestrian was hit by a car and killed on Route 372 in Cromwell, and another was killed on the Berlin Turnpike in Newington. A month or so later, in the last week of March, three pedestrians were killed in 4 days, including another on the Berlin Turnpike. As of April 16th, 21 pedestrians have been killed across the state in 2024. Two more than during the same period in both 2022 and 2023, according to data from the state's Highway Safety Office. Things are not good on our roadways, said Department of Transportation spokesman Josh Morgan. Things certainly haven't been good for the last couple of years, with 366 traffic fatalities in 2022 and 323 roadway deaths in 2023. Most, 223 and 205 respectively, were passengers in cars. Quite a few motorcyclists, 66 and 62, lost their lives in those years. Also, a stunning number of pedestrians, 73 in 2022 and 51 in 2023, were struck and killed, along with four bicyclists in 2022 and five in 2023. Here's the thing. Safety advocates say the deaths of pedestrians and bicyclists, sometimes called vulnerable users, are preventable. If so, why aren't they being prevented? An obvious and not incorrect response is bad driving, speeding, impaired or distracted driving, running red lights, etc. Sometimes a pedestrian takes an ill-considered risk. But in recent years, another factor has come to light: road design. Some think it should be at the top of the list that road design can induce bad driving. People drive at the speed the road is designed for, not at the posted speed, said Jay Stange, transportation specialist for the Center for Latino Progress in Hartford. Though cars are inherently dangerous, it is the design of the streets that make them deadly, according to a post from the New Haven Safe Streets Coalition, a safety advocacy group. The way we drive, walk, bike, and roll is determined by how we design our streets. Blaming bad drivers or irresponsible pedestrians ignores the real problem. Roads are built for cars, not people. We'll be back with more of the front pages after this message.
The American School for the Deaf Online Academy is the first accessible online education platform for deaf and hard of hearing students, serving over 200 students from around the world. It offers core academic subjects for middle and high school students, tutoring, enrichment programs, and American Sign Language as a world language courses for public schools. The program recently expanded to also provide accessible support services, including speech therapy and counseling. This telecare program offers direct access to therapeutic services for deaf and hard of hearing school-aged children without the need for an interpreter or third party. To learn more, visit their website, asd-1817.org. The American School for the Deaf. Always able.
Now's the time when we read obituaries by town. Bloomfield, Stephanie Russell. Bolton, Joyce Sambogna. Bristol, Andrew R. Cambo. Burlington, Jan L. Minor. Clinton, Marilyn H. Dwyer. Columbia, Jean E. Peters. Coventry, Thomas Wilstead. Cromwell, Nancy Seagrave. East Hartford, Marjorie Bonto. Ellington, Joseph A. Gagna, Jr. Enfield, Frank Cadis. Farmington, Margot J. Nugent. Glastonbury, John F. DuPont, Jr. Granby, Barbara Dutton. Hartford, Marlene Edland. Jerry Lynn Fields. John F. Kehoe. Eugene P. Lynch, Jr. Thomas C. Malley. Elizabeth Melly. Middletown, Natalie S. Byers. Peter J. Gillis. New Britain, Leocadia Jawin. Jeanette S. Moretti. Old Saybrook, Scott B. Gore. Simsbury, Harry A. Cook, Jr. Curtis S. Dudley. Southington, Esther Derry-Niosklu. Vernon, Andrew Boyko, Jr. West Hartford, Gregory L. Clark. William Lagazzo. Joan Matties. Windsor, Jacqueline B. Bennett. Gladys P. Lane. And Windsor Locks, Lauren L. Andriota. Well, now let's take a look at what is on TV for today. We'll be looking at primetime and the main channels, starting with CBS. They have a new episode of The Equalizer running from 8 to 9 p.m. That's followed by a new episode of Tracker running from 9 to 10 p.m. And that's followed by a new episode of CSI Vegas running from 10 to 11 p.m. On NBC, they have an episode of The Voice running from 8 to 10 p.m. And that's followed by a new episode of Dateline NBC running from 10 to 11 p.m. On Fox, it looks like it is a night of comedy, starting with a new episode of The Simpsons running from 8 to 8:30 p.m., followed by a new episode of Krapopolis running from 8:30 to 9 p.m. That's followed by a new episode of The Great North running from 9 to 9:30 p.m., and lastly, a new episode of Grimmsburg running from 9:30 to 10 p.m. On PBS coming out of Hartford, they have a schedule which is similar to PBS in Springfield, but slightly different in terms of timing. They're starting the evening with a new episode of Called the Midwife, running from 8 to 9 p.m. That's followed by an episode of Mr. Bates versus the Post Office on Masterpiece, running from 9 to 9:30 p.m. And then that's followed by an episode of Alice and Jack on Masterpiece, running from 9:30 until 11 p.m. The PBS channel coming out of Springfield, WGBY, has Called the Midwife running from 8 to 9 p.m. And that's a new episode, followed by a new episode of Mr. Bates versus the Post Office running on Masterpiece from 9 to 10 p.m. And that's followed by a new episode of Alice and Jack on Masterpiece running from 10 to 11 p.m. On ABC, they have American Idol running from 8 to 10 p.m., and that's followed by a new episode of What Would You Do? Running from 10 to 11 p.m. On TBS, they have a night of The Big Bang Theory with four episodes running from 8 to 8:30, 8:30 to 9, 9 to 9:30, and 9:30 to 10 p.m., followed by the 2019 movie Captain Marvel running from 10 p.m. until midnight. On ESPN, they have Major League Baseball starting at 7 p.m. and running until 10 p.m., followed by Stanley Cup Playoff starting at 10 p.m. and running until approximately midnight. On ESPN2, if you happen to get that, they have the Stanley Cup Playoff running from 7 p.m. until 10 p.m., followed by a new edition of SportsCenter running from 10 to 10:30 p.m. I'm sorry, running from 10 to 11 p.m. And another edition of SportsCenter Special running from 11 p.m. until midnight. On USA, it's a night of Law & Order Special Victims Unit with three episodes running from 8 to 9, 9 to 10, and 10 to 11 p.m. And finally on TLC, they have a new episode of 90 Day Fiancé, Happily Ever After, running from 8 until 10 p.m. Then that's followed by 90 Day Fiancé Pillow Talk, Happily Ever After, running from 10 to 10:30 p.m. And that's followed by a new episode of Love and Translation, running from 11 p.m. until midnight. Well, now get out those lottery numbers, because these are the lottery numbers from Saturday, April 20th. Play 3-day, 0, 8, 0. Wild ball 6. Play 4-day, 8, 5, 6, 1. Wild ball 3. The late numbers were not drawn in time for the edition that I am reading from, but we do have Friday's late numbers, and they are play 3 night, 1, 4, 8, wild ball 7. Play four, knight, 6, 3, 5, 9, long ball seven. Cash 5, 3, 6, 25, 27, 30. Lucky for life, 5, 8, 24, 28, 34. Lucky ball 5. Lotto, 2, 7, 9, 21, 25, 36. There were 0 first prize tickets sold. Mega Millions, 19, 30, 34, 46, 58. Mega Ball 3, Mega Plier 3. Tuesday's estimated Lotto jackpot, $2.4 million. Tuesday's estimated Mega Millions jackpot, $202 million. Well, now let's take a look at the almanac. Today is Sunday, April 21st, the 112th day of 2024. There are 254 days left in the year. Today in history, in 1836, an army of Texans led by Sam Houston defeated the Mexicans at San Jacinto, assuring Texas independence. In 1910, author Samuel Langhorne Clemens, better known as Mark Twain, died in Redding, Connecticut at age 74. In 1926, Britain's Queen Elizabeth II was born in Mayfair, London. She was the first child of the Duke and Duchess of York, who later became King George VI and the Queen Mother. In 1975, the Communist forces closing in, South Vietnamese President Nguyen Van Thieu resigned after nearly 10 years in office and fled the country. In 1976, clinical trials of the swine flu vaccine began in Washington, D.C. In 1980, Rosie Ruiz was the first woman to cross the finish line at the Boston Marathon. However, she was later exposed as a fraud. In 1998, astronomers announced in Washington that they had discovered possible signs of a new family of planets orbiting a star 220 light years away, the clearest evidence to date of worlds forming beyond our solar system. In 2013, Joe Scarborough, a 50-year-old self-employed electrical contractor, rolled the first 900 series in Professional Bowlers Association history, 3 straight perfect games. In 2015, an Egyptian criminal court sentenced ousted Islamist President Mohamed Morsi to 20 years in prison over the killing of protesters in 2012. Morsi collapsed and died during trial on espionage charges in June 2019. In 2016, Prince, one of the most inventive and influential musicians of modern times, was found dead at his home in suburban Minneapolis. He was 57. And in 2018, actor Vern Troyer, best known for his role as Mini-Me in the Austin Powers movies, died at age 49. Today's birthdays, actress Patti LuPone, best known for her role as Eva Perone in Tim Rice and Andrew Lloyd Webber's Broadway musical Evita, is 75. Actor Tony Danza, best known for co-starring in the television comedy series Taxi and Who's the Boss, is 73. Actress and former fashion model Andie MacDowell, who has co-starred in such movies as Groundhog Day, Four Weddings and a Funeral, and Sex, Lies, and Videotape, is 66. Actor-director John Cameron Mitchell, known as the writer, director, and star of the 2001 film Hedwig and the Angry Inch, is 61. Olympic gold medal pair figure skater Jamie Soleil is 47. Former NFL quarterback for 14 seasons with the Dallas Cowboys, Tony Romo, is 44. And actor Christoph Sanders, best known for his role as Kyle Anderson in the sitcom Last Man Standing, is 36. Well, that's all for this edition of the Front Pages. I'm Lisa Bowman, along with Scott Becker, and I've been reading from today's Hartford Current, New York Times, and Manchester Journal Inquirer. If you missed any part of this program, it will air again this evening at 6 and 11. It's also available anytime on our telephone reader service and on demand at our website, chrisradio.org. Thanks for listening and have a great day, everyone.